Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If you're eager to read Robert Mueller's report on the Russia investigation, you're not alone. And the president apparently thinks you should read it. This week, Mr. Trump said that he supports publishing the special counsel's findings. He also disparaged the report as ridiculous. Rumors of the report's impending release have been making the rounds for weeks now. Who knows? It could come out while we're on the air today, which would probably send our panelists running out of the studio to get back to their day jobs at light speed. So let's get to the stories that did make news right away, just in case. Joining us here in the studio is Jackie Kucinich, the Washington bureau chief of the Daily Beast. Jackie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, new to the roundup, is Evan McMorris Santoro, a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Evan, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And returning to our table is NPR politics reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Danielle, good to see you.
Hey, Joshua.
Let's set the Mueller report aside for a moment and start with Boeing. Multiple reports suggest that Boeing is now under investigation by the Department of Justice and the FBI. Sources told CNN the Justice Department's investigation began after a Boeing 737 MAX jet crashed in Indonesia last October. All 189 souls on board were lost. Less than 5 months after that, a second 737 MAX crashed in Ethiopia, taking 157 souls. So sources tell the Seattle Times that that is when the FBI jumped on board the investigation. Danielle, let me start with you. If the Justice Department has been investigating this plane since last year, what does that mean, particularly since the U.S. was one of the last countries to ground the fleets of 737s after this month's crash?
Well, that's a really big deal. And there's a lot about this investigation and the possibility of a criminal investigation that really sets this apart from other plane crashes. A criminal investigation, the Seattle Times has been doing some great reporting on this. A criminal investigation is pretty rare. Now, what they're investigating is the certification process, and the Department of Transportation, led by Elaine Chao, also is doing an audit, which is also relatively unusual in these sorts of cases. So, yeah, this is a big deal. And one other thing is that, once again, Seattle Times reporting, they found that the FAA had been saying, you know, we don't have enough funds, we don't have enough resources to do our own safety checks, safety assessments on these new airplanes. So they've been handing some of this off to Boeing, for example, in some of these new planes. So you can bet that that is going to be a really big vein of this, is the FAA saying, the DOJ saying, okay, FAA, why were you doing this? Why didn't you handle some of this yourself?
Evan, that's exactly what I was going to point to you with. I mean, we did have a larger conversation this week about the FAA, but that is one of the big threads in this story about how the FAA works, what the FAA delegates to airlines, and whether the relationship between the two is too cozy or if it is appropriately distant to give proper oversight.
Yeah, I mean, I too had the Seattle Times in my smartphone full of notes before coming in today. The fact that the airplane manufacturers are self-investigating themselves and working with the government on it, people need to go and read this story. It's absolutely amazing the way this works. In the spirit of recapping, I look at all of this in kind of a broader picture, which is in the past couple of weeks, we've learned that college admissions are completely phony and like completely, totally hacked. Airline manufacturers, they, you know, investigate themselves. Not to mention everything else we've learned about all sorts of other stuff in the past couple of years. This is a situation where, you know, when I'm out and about doing my reporting and people I talk to are skeptical of institutions, especially ones in this city here in Washington, this is why they are. Because planes have gone down and we find out that, oh, well, the FAA and Boeing, you know, they work together and Boeing said, hey, the plane's fine. And then after it's over with, Now the government steps in to do investigations.
By the way, Danielle, I forgot to ask you whether the Department of Justice has confirmed anything that the Seattle Times has reported, or have they just kind of stayed quiet on this?
As I understand it, they've stayed quiet on this, yeah.
Now, Jackie, speaking of investigations, the Pentagon's Inspector General has launched an ethics probe into Patrick Shanahan. He's the acting Secretary of Defense. Shanahan worked at Boeing for more than 30 years before he took his job at the Pentagon. What's this probe about, and what should we make of it so far?
Well, it's looking into whether he was promoting planes that Boeing made instead over those made by Boeing competitor Lockheed Martin, and saying positive things about planes that were made by Lockheed Martin. Now, Shanahan has welcomed this probe, as you know, public officials tend to do, but it is significant that they're looking into this. And, you know, we also need to mention, there hasn't been a head of the FAA. I mean, there's been an acting FAA administrator. Now, finally, there's someone nominated. But this agency has been acting without a permanent head. And another thing I wanted to mention, as Congress starts to look into this, our Lachlan Marquet over at the Daily Beast found that in February, Boeing donated or gave more money than they ever have in 1 month to members of Congress, $827,000 in 1 month. Now, this is before this latest crash. However, that's never an accident.
Right.
They don't just, you know.
I mean, something like $15 million in lobbying last year. They're number 10 in the top 10. Lobbying. I mean, this is the thing. This is all going to move into Congress now. And when you're watching these members of Congress, the actual committee, the Senate Transportation Committee that will be taking this issue up, their staff director is a former Boeing lobbyist.
Right.
Just the whole thing is kind of like, I just feel like we're really peeling the lid off of something people need to be thinking a lot about when it comes to how Washington works.
Right. Well, and on top of what you said earlier, those really smart points you made on people's lack of trust in institutions. On top of that, you just add the very basic fact that Boeing is such a huge federal contractor. I mean,
right.
It just seems like there are so many lines, like pieces of yarn you could put on your corkboard here between the government and Boeing.
Danielle, with regards to these hearings, what do we expect to come out of them? Are there any specific questions that senators have said that they will raise from these hearings?
I mean, once again, I think you can bet that they're going to ask about the certification process, why, and also this safety assessment process. Why was Boeing involved in this so heavily? But I mean, the FAA is also going to come forward. It is not just the head of Boeing. So I would imagine there would also be questions about, you know, why other countries were ahead of the United States and saying, all right, we're not going to fly these Boeing jets that have been involved in two crashes.
It is not, you know, not lost on me the impact of Boeing, for sure, Jackie. I mean, when you land at Washington National Airport, when you're driving away from the airport, you look across the street and there's a big building that says Boeing in huge letters.
Right. Yeah.
So the political heft of this company, how does that play into the investigation? One would hope that the political heft of Boeing wouldn't stand in the way of safety, of air safety. And that's what I think what the FAA has been intimating, that it can investigate this without worrying about how much money Boeing spends on the Hill.
Well, right. Again, one would hope. But you find when there's this much of a microscope and when it involves public safety, you have a lot of speechifying about the independence of Congress. But, well, I mean, and, you know, we would hope that and there's going to be a lot of public pressure to make sure that, you know, legislators and the FAA get to the bottom of what happened here. But once these, as Evan said, once the lid starts being pulled from this, sometimes people won't like what they see. So I think these hearings are going to be very important. And, you know, we should keep an eye on how much money Boeing starts kicking in and who their lobbyists are talking to. This is all public information. And I know we're going to be keeping an eye on it.
One of our listeners on our website, the1a.org, writes, it cost them billions in the short term, hurt their reputation, and put their company's long-term prospects at risk. Regulation saves money and lives. That was also one of the discussions that came out this week in terms of the scope of the FAA, and it's changed over the years.
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to be clear on the fact that I can't speak for my colleagues here, but I'm not an aviation reporter or expert.
Nor
in terms,
am I.
In terms of the actual nature of this plane, you know, American Airlines have backed this plane. The FAA has backed this plane. There's still there are a lot of questions about what actually happened with the plane. All I can talk about is what happens now with how this thing becomes politicized. It's now a political issue, right? Every politician wants a piece of it. Everyone wants to make their point. And as we look through that process, we have to look at the fact that this is a massive defense contractor, as we've mentioned, that has massive lobbying power. Regulation, you know, the U.S. sort of, these companies don't want their planes to fall out of the sky. Nobody wants that to happen. But what we're learning now are the practicalities of how this government is dealing with these massive corporations, with that push-pull that we have in this country endlessly between letting capitalists run free and letting regulators hold them back.
And I just wanted to add, I think we're also going to know how closely they're looking into this as to who they're talking to. Pilot unions, people who had been complaining about these planes before these things happened.
Two Supreme Court stories caught our eye this week. The so-called DC sniper may yet face life in prison without parole now that the Supreme Court will reconsider his case. Lee Boyd Malvo took part in a series of attacks back in 2002. 10 people were killed in the Washington metro area. At the time, Malvo was 17, and justices ruled that mandatory life sentences without parole for minors were unconstitutional. Also this week, Justice Clarence Thomas spoke during oral arguments for the first time in 3 years. His question was about the case of Curtis Flowers, a death row inmate featured in the podcast In the Dark. Flowers has been tried in Mississippi for the same crime 6 times. 2 ended in hung juries, and 3 convictions were thrown out because of prosecutorial misconduct. At issue is whether this 6th trial, another conviction, should also be thrown out over attempts to weed out black jurors. Justice Thomas asked what Flowers' defense attorneys did to reject whites during jury selection. Let's talk about a few environmental stories that made news this week, starting with the flooding across parts of the Midwest. A number of governors have declared states of emergencies, including in Nebraska, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Missouri. Iowa's governor has issued a disaster proclamation. What sense do we have, Danielle, of the scope of these floods? A lot of people are saying that these are absolutely historic.
Yeah, I mean, in a word, huge. And I gotta say, I'm from Iowa, and talking to my parents back home, my dad is actually a farmer. And I hear a lot about, like, listen, it's March, which means it is about planting season in Iowa and Nebraska for corn and soybeans, which, of course, are, you know, massive exports, massive things that we sell in the country from those states. So those farmers have already been hit by tariffs. And now on top of that, they are hit by this act of God, which really could hurt their yields this year and their sales this year. So economically, it's huge. I mean, and even leaving that aside, last I checked, there were 4 deaths related to these. Nebraska is saying it's losing $1.3 billion from these floods. Iowa will also lose a lot of money. It's absolutely gargantuan.
Jackie, NOAA has said that we have an unprecedented spring flood season on the way. We're up to 25 states could endure serious flooding. Climate change is a hot button issue, particularly going into 2020. I hate to make a human disaster about politics too much, but considering what we're ramping up for, it's kind of impossible not to.
Right. And I think when you talk to farmers, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you don't really, I feel like most farmers don't debate climate change. It just is a thing. I mean, it's a thing they have to deal with. I mean, it depends on where you are.
Yeah, but, it depends. But yeah, I mean, a fair number, yeah, have to contend with the fact that the weather has changed a lot over their lifetimes.
Right. And so, you know, it's not, and you know, you already mentioned that a lot of these folks have already been hit by the tariffs. And that's something that, in talking politically, both the representatives from those areas and the president is going to have to contend with going into 2020. Not only that, I mean, there have been subsidies for a lot of these farmers who have been hit by tariffs. And when you talk to senators from those areas, they say that farmers don't want government money. They want to be able to sell their product and make it themselves, but they feel like they have to take it. So will there be more money appropriated to these places that have been hit by the floods? Most likely. And again, this is something that Congress is going to have to contend with, and largely those up for re-election in 2020 are going to have to explain.
Evan, also it's something that I think voters are going to have to contend with on one level or another. Nitesh writes on Twitter, when do we start taking responsibility for climate change? Why don't we take measures to use renewable resources? When will we end our quest for big SUVs? Why are we always waiting for the government to tell us? Be interesting to see how these kinds of natural disasters affect the electorate going into 2020.
Well, this is a real rubber meets the road moment in terms of the political conversation that we're having. I did a story with farmers for Vice News tonight on HBO, 7:30 p.m. weeknights. like I did it last year, and it was about farmers who are going through intense psychological stress because of the decline in this case dairy prices, that farmers are having to sort of form these ad hoc support groups to try to keep each other from killing themselves. I mean, there's a lot of really tough stuff going on in the farm country right now.
Wait. Suicide
support groups in this case Wisconsin to try to prevent people from, because you know you're alone on your out in your farm. The prices are going nowhere. There's no money. I mean, part of this flooding story, the Nebraska Agriculture Department says that over the past 5 years, farmers in that state have lost 60% of their income. I mean, we're talking about huge, huge economic problems. But on the other hand, those same farmers that I was talking to in the middle of this time where, you know, they can talk about tariffs hurting their bottom line and climate change and everything else, they love this president. Right. And they love the Republican Party. I mean, I was just in Iowa, not from Iowa, but I was just in Iowa this week doing a story, and it was in Davenport, Iowa, following Democratic candidates. In downtown Davenport, I ran into a guy who saw me interviewing people and pulled me aside and said, hey, I'm a Trump supporter, but I don't want to tell anybody in here, and I'm kind of feeling not that great about him anymore. I don't know. And 15 minutes down the road is the world's largest truck stop on Iowa 80, it's called. And everybody in there was wearing a Donald Trump hat, and they were perfectly happy to do it. This is the real question for Democrats and for the rest of everybody else going forward, right? Is that if you're a farmer losing 60% of your income, but you also really don't like what Ilhan Omar said, right? What do you do? Yeah. And nobody has any idea what those people are going to do yet. And that's really what the Democrats have to worry about in the Midwest.
With regards to the human aspect of this, Ron on Facebook writes, why does it matter what the reason is? We're probably past the point of stopping this rolling disaster. It's all about mitigation now, isn't it? Danielle?
Well, yeah. And I mean, to add to what Evan said, one thing that I'm interested in is I was just on the campaign trail in New Hampshire following Beto O'Rourke around. And prior to that, I was following Bernie Sanders through New York and Chicago. And why I say that is that I've seen these candidates, say their usual applause lines, but the line that overwhelmingly every time gets among the biggest applause, if not the biggest applause at any rally or any stop, is about climate change. Democrats, at least Democratic primary voters, are very fired up about this. But the interesting thing is going to be, go out to Iowa, watch the Iowa primary voters and the non-primary voters, maybe the more moderate Iowans, like some of those farmers or more conservative Iowans, I guess, and see how do they feel about it. Does that appeal to them, or do they just shrug it off as, you know, part of a culture war or something like that. Mm.
Another environmental story that caught our attention this week, an Obama-era appointed federal judge has ruled that the Bureau of Land Management, which is part of the Department of Interior, has broken the law. The ruling on Tuesday said the violation happened when the Bureau failed to thoroughly assess the impact of oil and gas leasing in Wyoming. The judge temporarily blocked drilling on 300,000 acres of land in Wyoming. Now, Jackie Kucinich, this is a temporary block, but right. This case is significant. It's kind of bringing the climate change argument into federal policy and federal regulation.
The politics that we've seen played out across the country, I think, are going to also play out here. You have the governor of Wyoming, Mark Gordon, saying that they might appeal this decision. They're talking a lot about jobs. You have Senator Barrasso from Wyoming saying that this is blocking people from, you know, employment. So again, you have the environment pitted against potential jobs, and that is going to be the lens through, you know, that partisans see this through, just talking sheer politics.
And don't you feel like as long as that conversation is jobs versus the environment, the people talking about the jobs are on the better side of that argument.
Depends on who you're talking to, yeah, I guess.
I mean, that's an issue that this is about, is that, like, when you're talking about a situation like this drilling issue, and this is actually an Obama era lease,
yes,
that the judge said the problem with the lease was that it didn't take into account the climate change potential from the actual carbon removed from the ground and burned, right? Which is something that, like, environmentalists have been talking about for a long time. They want to leave stuff in the ground to keep it from being burned off. But if the argument is nobody gets a job because we don't drill, that's a very tough argument to have, right? This is, I mean, when we talked to when your caller or the smart reader wrote in about this, this is really the difficulty, is that the Democrats need to make it so they're not talking about there's no jobs here. Then you talk about all the jobs you're going to get because you don't drill that stuff out of the ground.
Right. Well,
although, Danielle, it is worth noting, you know, we were in Colorado earlier this month in Greeley, Colorado, which is the heart of oil and gas country. We aired part of our conversation from there just this week. And if you talk to people who work in oil and gas, which was a significant contingent of the audience at this event, they take a great deal of pride in doing an honest day's work for an honest day's wage. Mm-hmm. In working for an industry that the nation needs, because we're not ready to go all renewable yet at all. We're not even close.
Right.
And also working in an industry that, from their perspective, has gone farther toward being more ecologically friendly, so that its environmental footprint is smaller now than it's ever been. So it's not as black and white when you look on the ground.
Right, yeah. And I mean, they're right. And I imagine they have this feeling of, haven't we gone far enough? Well, it depends on which ecologist you ask about.
Or we'll go even farther, but yeah, this job needs to still exist.
Right. But this, speaking of jobs, though, I mean, this kind of pivots off of what Evan was saying, is that this is the very tough rhetorical turn that Democrats are trying to make here with, for example, the Green New Deal, is trying to tell voters, listen, we need to stop climate change, but also that doesn't mean fewer jobs. In fact, it can mean more jobs. Now, how convincing that's being is, once again, hyper-polarizing. I think it's hard to find an issue out there right now, or a proposal, I suppose, that makes voters either more super excited or super angry and yelling than the Green New Deal right now.
Crystal wrote on our Facebook page, I am also from Iowa, and speaking to my parents back home, getting political, they were Trump supporters. They were hit by the tariffs for their crops. They're dealing with climate change, but they are still avid Trump supporters. Let's talk about the White House, the administration this week. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has been spending time at a Border Patrol station in McAllen, Texas, right on the U.S.-Mexico border. At a press conference yesterday, she said the U.S. was being forced to release immigrants coming into the country because of a lack of detention space. Now, Jackie, some immigration lawyers have argued that the Trump administration is releasing undocumented immigrants for political reasons. The secretary says that it's resource related. Who's, like, what do we read from this? Is either right? Are they both right?
I think it's, I mean, it I don't know the answer to your question, honestly. This is an issue that's become so polarizing in this country in terms of what the administration is doing. I mean, the ACLU filed a complaint yesterday, I think, saying that detainees that have religious beliefs aren't having those honored. There are complaints every day in terms of how detainees are being treated. So, and, you know, then you have, you know, the administration making their arguments. So I think I can't answer your question right now, to be perfectly honest.
That is a wonderfully honest answer. That kind of sums it up. Well, beyond that, Evan, Secretary Nielsen also called on Congress to enact new immigration laws to give Homeland Security more resources to deal with border issues. Maybe this is another question that doesn't have an answer, but I wonder where we stand now, and I'll give it to you, Evan. This is how we haze the new guy.
Great.
In terms of where Congress stands on immigration policy. I mean, the border wall was super galvanizing and kind of forced everyone into corners, but in terms of the more granular aspects of policy, what now? Where are we?
Well, if you go to Congress and you yell into an open hallway, do you support border security? Everybody in that hallway is going to yell back, yes. What does that mean? I don't know.
Then you have to go into offices and ask them what that means.
One by one by one, yeah.
You're going to get a million different answers, right? I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, was not that controversial too long ago, right? The idea, okay, so we're going to, you know, put some more security on the border. We want to make sure the border is, you know, things we don't want coming across, you know, aren't coming across. We have, we can look at the things that are coming in. But now it's such a political football that it's very difficult for anybody to have any kind of honest conversation about it, really. I mean, I do feel like the Democrats have put forward their ideas and they're for border security ideas, but they're not the wall or whatever. And meanwhile, when we're talking about what Jackie was just stumped by, and I am also stumped by this unanswerable question, this is a question of people who are not even criminals or like in prison. They're like guests of the United States. We can't even figure out how to treat those people. So it's very intractable right now. And all I can say is from what I heard on the campaign trail this week and the previous week, Democrats are kind of leaning away from talking a whole ton about border security the way I heard them talking. That these Democratic candidates were talking more about compassion, more about why people actually do make this trek, especially we're talking about these young unaccompanied minors and why they might, you know, their parents might send them from Honduras to walk all the way to the United States. That's a slight rhetorical shift. It's a bit anecdotal. I don't have enough information to say it's like happening all over the place. Right. But these candidates are not doing what they were doing before. If you think about like Obama, for example, leaning very heavily into border security in the hopes that that brings the more conservatives to their side. They're saying, look, this is a humanitarian crisis. Most of these people are good people. We need to do the right thing and stand by them. And that's not the kind of thing that brings people to the other side.
Although, Danielle, with regards to Congress, there might be a time peg for this because we're in budget season. So that might be one of these moments where we do get a little expression from at least some members of Congress of what they want Homeland Security to have or not have with regard to the border.
Right. I mean, I guess in terms of the budget, it's like you were asking Jackie and Evan is, okay, so should DHS have more funds to be able to handle all of these immigrants who are coming in? Because why are these immigrants being released? Well, the Customs and Border Patrol is saying that it's because they don't have the space for them. There's just overcrowding. So if you ask members of Congress, hey, appropriate these funds, I think the question, of course, is, and once again, I have to say, I don't know what's going to happen, but the question is, what will that money be used for? I mean, to lock more people up, I think you'd have plenty of members of Congress who would say, no, thank you. Now, if it's to deal with more immigration cases, more asylum cases, for example, which I don't know if the Trump administration would propose that, but I imagine you would have people say yes. So it's all about the what the money is for, if not necessarily the amount of money.
Let's talk a bit about a comment that the president made. And for reasons that seem a little unclear, he renewed his attacks on the late Senator John McCain. He was speaking to workers at a tank manufacturing plant in Lima, Ohio.
I've never liked them much. Hasn't been for me. I've really probably never will.
That was President Trump speaking in Lima, Ohio. Jackie, why would the president say this?
Where do I begin? So it is clear the president doesn't like John McCain. He associates now John McCain with the Steele dossier because of a report that, you know, McCain was given this and he gave it to the FBI. And because of that, the president now thinks that John McCain was trying to implicate him. So, I don't know that there's a lot of political thought that goes into the president slamming John McCain. There are reports that, you know, he thinks it galvanizes the base. There are lots of things that galvanize the president's base. The base is going to be with the president no matter what. And his staff has asked him to stop doing this. You've even seen members of Congress this week start speaking out. I mean, Senator Johnny Isaacson from Georgia is not known for being a firebrand by any stretch of the imagination. And yet he went on NPR this week in Georgia, I believe, to speak out against what the president is doing and to defend John McCain. You had a Congressman Crenshaw tweet, stop talking about John McCain. Lindsey Graham, who was John McCain's best friend, was more tepid, but, you know, asked the president to stop talking about John McCain. It's really uncomfortable for Republicans when the president does this. But this is a grievance that the president will not let go. And I think he thinks that John McCain had the last word and he can't let it go.
I will say this. It is now my new life goal to upset a president from beyond the grave.
Right, right.
Like John McCain has really got this going. Well, yeah, with, you know, if you build the right life together,
it's kind of an afterlife goal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But,
I find afterlife goal, right. An afterlife goal.
Well even, it, even on yeah, Fox yeah. Business, you had the Maria. I'm going to say
Bartiromo.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Say, you know, he can't punch back. John McCain cannot punch back from beyond the grave. What is the president doing?
Well, but the other narrative through this, Danielle, in terms of punching back, has to do with Republicans who said nothing about the comment.
Right.
Former Ohio Governor John Kasich blasted the president on Twitter and on TV. He is now a political analyst on CNN. And here is what Governor Kasich said about why he thought members of Congress were reluctant to condemn President Trump.
Careerism over leadership. You know, I'm in office. I want to stay in office. I kind of like it. You know, I'm a United States senator. I'm like a flamingo. I get to flap around and be important. And sometimes you can be addicted to a job like that.
Like a flamingo.
Flap around.
That's very evocative.
It's vivid. But I do take his point, Danielle, this idea that the president might, that opposing the president, even on something that just is kind of an offhanded, you know, remark, mm-hmm. might be politically threatening, because it might.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's fitting that John Kasich, political analyst, said that, you know, and criticizing his colleagues who are still politicians. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you saw this in the range of responses people had, right? Like Johnny Isaacson, I believe the word he used was deplorable. Joni Ernst, the senator, Republican senator from Iowa, likewise criticized Trump. But then you had this middle ground of Republicans who, they didn't say nothing, but they just went on Twitter, for example, and said, John McCain was a great guy. He was a hero, but these senators didn't actually say anything against President Trump.
Well, this is a golden oldie of Trumpery, though, if you think back, right?
Oh, sure.
What is the first time in Trump's campaign for president that everybody thought it was over? It was in Iowa when he is sitting next to Frank Luntz, mm-hmm. and he says, "I like people who didn't get captured." Every reporter, every Republican was like, he's done, he's doomed. And of course, he went on to win most of the primaries and then the White House. So I think not to like, you know, say it's a profile in courage to not stand up for John McCain here. But like the fact is, Trump has proven over and over and over again, the Republicans are not going to leave him if he attacks John McCain.
Well, and even beyond that, Jackie, I think, you know, during the latter part of Senator McCain's life, he kind of represented the old school Republican Party, right. and also the old school Senate when he gave that speech where he called for a return to regular order and tried to get his colleagues to ignore the pundits on cable news. That something about the senator, and particularly in his funeral, which nearly everyone who spoke kind of alluded to one way or another, held him up as an example of the way Washington used to be, for better or worse. But that's kind of what he stood for.
And that's what the president ran against. Now, I think it was more personal with the president and John McCain. I don't think that's the only reason. And, you know, there was a lot of John McCain's funeral that was a direct rebuke of the president. The president wasn't invited to John McCain's funeral. So I think that grievance runs deep. I think the biggest difference now is that, I mean, when John McCain was alive, he could defend himself or, you know, brush off what the president says. It's now that, you know, he's been gone 7 months and the president is still attacking him, not only for his health care vote, but also for the thumbs down, but also for, you know, his involvement, I guess, with the Steele dossier.
Speaking of presidential feuds, Danielle, there's one other that we wanted to touch on very briefly, that the president has kind of been all over George Conway, the husband of
of
his top aides, Kellyanne Conway.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I'll be getting on that Boeing 737 MAX 8 now.
Yeah, okay. No, but it's what is this about, and does it matter in the scheme of things?
No.
Okay.
Next question. No, oh, sorry.
So we'll answer the second part first. No, really, I mean, this is kind of an ongoing storyline about Kellyanne Conway being a fierce supporter of the president and one of his most, let's say, effective kind of media, you know, defenders. And then George Conway, her husband, being very vocal about his dislike of the president and it becoming increasingly a public flashpoint.
Right. And I want to be clear, like, forgive me for being flip. I was just telling Jackie before we came in the studio, like, I don't even know what to say about this. Because, listen, it doesn't matter. I mean, in the grand scheme of the problems facing this country. That's what I mean. No, it doesn't. But I mean, it does show it does show just how intense the fault lines are with this president. It's just, it feels a little bit odd, maybe even gross, to watch a couple's marital spats be public. But yes, what has been going on is that Kellyanne Conway, of course, spokeswoman for the president, is always out there defending him. And George Conway, her husband, is constantly on Twitter. Lately, he has been questioning the president's mental fitness to hold this office. I got to be honest, I don't know what else to say about it. It strikes me as honestly kind of picayune. I don't know if it's really that big of a deal.
Well,
right?
It shows, just kind of in a broader sense, it shows the inability of the president to ignore this, to ignore Twitter, mm-hmm. to ignore a slight. And yes, this is the husband of one of his top aides. But if he didn't elevate it, it would be, you know, Washington speak. It's the fact that the president is elevating it and addressing it makes it more of a national issue, frankly. Not a national issue in terms that that's going to affect anybody, but mm-hmm. he's elevated him so that we're talking about it instead of it just being sort of a Twitter thing.
Yeah, it's a Streisand effect.
Let's shift the Streisand effect?
Yeah, this is I don't remember the story exactly, but it's the term for the phenomenon where something bad happens or something potentially embarrassing in your life happens, and you talk about it, and that directs attention towards it in a way that you don't want it to. Or like you try to keep people away from a topic, and that just brings more attention to the topic. Is the best.
Interesting.
That's very good. You should write a book about this president.
Gosh,
all the Streisand effect, because that is exactly what happens every week with this guy.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears from that to the other big speculation in Washington. It's the one we alluded to at the beginning of the program, and we don't want to ignore it. We should touch on it a bit because the speculation has grown for months over when Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report into the 2016 election will finally be released. It could be any day now. It could be any moment. It could have already come out. We don't know. But at a press conference on Wednesday, the president weighed in on whether the report should be made available to the public. Here's part of what he said.
I just won one of the greatest elections of all time in the history of this country, and even you will admit that. And now I have somebody writing a report that never got a vote. It's called the Mueller Report. So explain that, because my voters don't get it, and I don't get it. Now, at the same time, let it come out. Let people see it. That's up to the attorney general. We have a very good attorney general. He's a very highly respected man, and we'll see what happens. But it's sort of interesting that a man out of the blue just writes a report.
That's President Trump speaking on Wednesday. Evan, what do we make of the president's apparent endorsement of this report?
Well, I don't think he has...
Or at least the endorsement of its publication, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I don't think he has much choice. This thing is going to come out one way or another, right? It's going to be very complicated and convoluted the way it comes out. And also, I mean, just to look back in the sands of time a bit, you know, the Ken Starr report came out against Bill Clinton, and he stayed president. I mean, we don't know what this report's going to say. We don't know what this report's going to do. We do know that there aren't enough votes in the United States Senate to remove this president from office via the impeachment process at this point. I mean, something really remarkable would have to happen. So, look, he's going to have to suffer through this news cycle no matter what. Why say I don't want it? I mean, he could say whatever he wants, but I'm just saying, like, it doesn't. History says he can weather this, and Trump definitely believes that he can.
We also should note, Jackie, that the report is not designed to just be dropped to the public. Like, there's a process that the report is intended to go through first.
Right. I mean, so the attorney general will decide, you know, what is released. And the White House will also try to get things redacted that they will say is part of privilege. But to Evan's point, I think if this didn't come out, if the president tried to bury it, that would be an issue. That would be, what are you hiding? And we should also note, things don't end with the Mueller report. There are several congressional investigations going on. I can't imagine that Mueller won't be in front of one of these committees at one point talking about the report. There are, you know, I think three congressional committees I can think of that have ongoing investigations. This doesn't end. this is the beginning once this report is released.
Right.
Danielle, what do we know about the Attorney General's stance on what to do with the Mueller report once he gets it? Has he said anything about making it public?
So he was asked in his, William Barr, the Attorney General, was asked in his confirmation hearings, will you make this report public, flat out? I'm paraphrasing here. And he didn't commit to saying yes. He has said he, I believe his wording was something to the effect of, as much of it as I can. But we don't know 100% for sure what he's going to make public.
And we should be clear, he doesn't have to make the report public. That's not part of the deal.
No, there are rules in place that sort of outline what he has to put in this report, the sort of here's who we're charging, here's who we're not, here are the whys and wherefores of it, but we don't exactly know. But he does have a fair amount of discretion, as I understand it, on this. Yeah.
Evan, do we know why this round of speculation has kicked up? I mean, I've been seeing the phrase any day now on cable news for like the last 24 hours. Why do people here in D.C. seem to think that it's imminent?
Well, when it comes to Washington, I just read what Jackie's reporters say, and then I just say that that's what
it is. I can say our reporter Max Tenney wrote a great piece a week or two ago about how many times the Mueller report release has been imminent. It's a fun read. Definitely read it.
I mean, look, it sounds to me like if you liked Mueller anticipation coverage, just wait till you have did we see the whole report coverage.
Oh, man.
I mean, it sounds like we got chyrons for days on this thing still coming.
Oh,
that's the recap, I think.
But what I will say is we do have the occasional breadcrumb that hints that it's coming soon, right? For example, and I'm plugging my colleague's work shamelessly here, my colleague Carrie Johnson at NPR recently reported that Andrew Weissman, one of the top prosecutors involved in this, recently said that he's leaving soon. He's going to go teach at NYU. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing that feeds this speculation that, like, oh, well, maybe they don't need this guy anymore. Maybe he's about done.
But they're kind of winding down.
Sweet tea leaves.
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely, yeah. But it's not that this comes out of nowhere, you know. There's just reporters get these bits and pieces, and everybody tries to look at the puzzle.
It's just the extrapolation that kind of gets people into.
Oh, most definitely.
Mueller was wearing a hat yesterday. You know what that means.
It was cold.
It was sunny.
Interesting take. Okay.
You know, usually at the end of the show, the kicker is the funny part. I could just leave it to the three of you. Why don't you two finish this line of logic? I don't need to read these last two pages. Go ahead.
Jackie, go.
These are the jokes.
That's it.
No. I'm going to shift gears and give you one more story that has nothing to do with politics, or maybe everything to do with politics. There is a fake cow who has been the focus of a lawsuit this week from Republican Congressman Devin Nunes of California. His beef, get it, is with a fake Twitter account named Devin Nunes Cow. It's at Devin Cow. The account's creator takes delight in insulting Nunes and other conservatives, and the congressman is suing for defamation. But the lawsuit's impact might have backfired. The parody account now has 615,000 followers. That is 200,000 more followers than Nunes's account has. One last story that is pretty cheesy. Scientists in Switzerland performed a unique dairy experiment. They played music into cheese that is aging to see how the tunes might affect the taste. They held a contest for which genre created the tastiest one. Led Zeppelin versus Mozart versus A Tribe Called Quest. And of course, hip-hop won. Because if you want to make anything delicious, it's got to be funky. NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Danielle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jackie Kucinich, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Daily Beast. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you very much.
And Evan McMorris Santoro, correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Evan, thanks very much.
This is really fun. Great show. Thanks.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Wake up the dead, so pay attention. It's not hard to decipher. And after the horns, you can check out the Viper.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states, and LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
On the new episode of Invisibilia, our relationship to uncertainty. What do you do when you have no idea what to do?
Maybe everything that we've thought was right is wrong. Maybe we're living life upside down. I don't know.
That's up next on Invisibilia.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. President Trump signaled a major foreign policy shift, endorsing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. He made that surprise endorsement yesterday on Twitter. 6 days after a brutal attack on two mosques in New Zealand, its government announced a ban on military-style assault weapons. The EU granted Britain's prime minister a brief extension to the Brexit deadline, with some conditions. Brazil's new president made a visit to the White House, where the so-called Trump of the tropics received glowing praise from our president, and Peppa the Pig took some heat in London. Plenty to discuss today in the Friday News Roundup. Joining us in studio to discuss it is Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter for NBC News. Courtney, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for McClatchy with a focus on immigration and foreign policy. Franco, welcome.
Great to be here.
And joining us from London, Michael Goldfarb, the host of the podcast First Rough Draft of History. Michael, welcome back to the Roundup.
Pleasure to be here, Joshua.
Let's begin with Israel and that tweet from the president. Here's what he posted on Twitter yesterday. Quote, "After 52 years, it is time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability," unquote. Before we get to the import of that tweet, Courtney Kuby, just explain the Golan Heights to us. What is it? Where is it? Why does it matter?
Okay, so this is a small area along Israel's northern border with Syria. It's sort of a plateau. It sits slightly higher. The history was it was captured by Israel from Syria at the end of the Six-Day War in 1967. Israel began to settle the area. Some of the Syrian Arabs fled. Some stayed behind. Syria tried to retake it from Israel in 1973, and despite the fact that the Israeli military took a lot of casualties, they were actually able to thwart the attempt and hold on to it. The following year, they agreed to an armistice that led to a UN observer force being along the armistice line that's been in place since then. Fast forward to 1981, Israel annexed the Golan Heights in a move that was not recognized internationally and remains not recognized by the international community. It now is about half Syrian, mainly Druze sect of the religion, and about half Israeli. So at this point, there's two UN resolutions, Security Council resolutions, that declare that it is not Israeli-owned and administered territory. But since 1981, they have claimed it as an annexed location for them.
So who actually controls the Golan Heights now?
The people who are in favor of President Trump's move of saying that Israel is in charge of it would argue that, in fact, this is just something that has been an accepted fact, that Israel has been in charge of it. But the reality is, according to the UN and according to the vast majority of nations around the world, it is Israeli-occupied territory. But what's interesting, I mean, President Trump, he's in that tweet, he was right in that this area does hold a very strategic importance to the Israelis. As I mentioned, it's a plateau. It sits somewhat high. It's right along the border with Syria. You know, it borders Syria. And because it sits somewhat high, it actually holds a military strategic value to them. Israel can literally see into Syria, and it has a natural, you know, buffer zone, too, to any kind of a military force that might want to invade Israel from Syria. And this, of course, comes at a time where Iran is just so dug on the ground in Syria that's an important value to Israel right now.
Michael Goldfarb, I wanted to get your take also on that part of the tweet where he referred to strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and to regional stability. What do you make of that part of the tweet, regional stability?
Well, there is no regional stability. I mean, actually, the Golan has been about as stable as it gets in that part of the world. There's a fascinating article by Stephen Cook in Foreign Policy this week noting that, you know, really, it's an announcement about something that's kind of de facto accepted around the region, that this is, you know, Israel's annexation may not be legal, but that Israel is not going to be pushed off. So the other reason for this is, of course, you know, President Trump is doing his good friend, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are solid here. There's an election in Israel in a couple of weeks, and Bibi Netanyahu enthusiastically tweeted about, this is a miracle, this is a miracle. You know, he's doing him a favor by stating the obvious at a time when it wasn't really in dispute. And, you know, what's interesting, I'd just like to add in, is that in the New York Times write-up of this, I saw a quote from Saeb Erekat, who's the veteran Palestinian Authority peace negotiator. I mean, he's been at this for decades, and why he still is at it as opposed to a new generation is another question. But he says there'll be certain destabilization and bloodshed in our region because of this. And you think, you know, in Syria and in Yemen, there are real wars going on. There's already tremendous destabilization. And so it's more about electoral politics, both in the U.S., where Donald Trump consolidates his connections with conservative-leaning American Jewish community, mm-hmm. and it's about Netanyahu getting electoral benefit because, you know, many Israelis like the idea that there's an American president who seems to be so very close and interested in Israel.
With regards to that election, Wanda emailed, is anyone really surprised by Trump's pronouncement that Israel has sovereignty over the Golan Heights? It's his buddy, Bibi. Netanyahu is in a tough battle for re-election, and Donald is doing everything he can to help him. Is it any coincidence that Netanyahu is coming to the White House next week ahead of the April election? Well, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did speak at a joint press conference alongside Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Netanyahu called the move by President Trump a miracle.
He did it again. First, he recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy here. Then he pulled out of the disastrous Iran treaty. But now he did something of equal historic importance.
That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking at a joint press conference with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Franco Ordonez, what do you make of the argument that the president is just doing this to help prop up Netanyahu ahead of this election next month?
I mean, I agree with much of what Michael was saying, that this was a solid for Netanyahu. I've been talking with sources for weeks about how Trump was, you know, watching this election, being very interested, and there was a lot of speculation about what could this administration do to help Netanyahu in an appropriate manner. Look, historically, the United States presidents have kind of stayed out of foreign elections like this, but Trump is no ordinary president. Let's also remember that it was not that long ago that when he announced pulling troops out of Syria, Netanyahu and Israel were very, very concerned. This is a dramatic turn of events. It's a huge favor, and you heard it there when Netanyahu said he did it again. The longer clip, you could hear it in his voice in the pause. It was amazing. You combine that with moving the embassy to Jerusalem. There's so much that President Trump has done to help Netanyahu. You mentioned the visit next week by Netanyahu. That is going to be seen as a campaign stop. This is a life raft for Netanyahu, who is really, really in danger of losing.
Courtney, there's another aspect of this worth talking about. And Richard Haass, who's the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, referred to it today in his interview on NPR's Morning Edition. Here's part of what he said.
Well, whatever little chance the United States had to be an effective, honest broker and to try to negotiate any peace between Israelis and the Palestinians, I think that's essentially eliminated.
That was Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking on Morning Edition. What about that assessment, this idea that the U.S. can no longer be considered an honest broker after this?
Well, so part of that is because this comes right before the expected release or announcement of the administration's plan for Middle East peace. The expectation is that that was going to come out after the elections in Israel in a couple of weeks. You know, I think one reason that so many people are questioning and critical of the timing of this announcement is that there was no obvious inflection point. You know, Michael mentioned that there's not been some tensions that have been overflowing in the area. There were talks between Israel and Syria for some time about what was going to happen in the Golan Heights, but they broke down when the Syrian civil war began 8 years ago. So there was no obvious turning point that was coming or decision point that was looming that led to this, which is leading so many people to look at this and say, well, what's coming? It's the Israeli elections. We have Netanyahu, who's a very close friend of President Trump and of, you know, first son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who faces a starkly, strongly contested race. He's running against a popular former army chief, Benny Gantz. And it comes at a time where he also may be facing indictment, charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. And, you know, as Michael mentioned, President Trump really did him a solid. What everyone forgets, though, is that this is actually one of the tweets from President Trump that really has no practical impact. You know, it's not like the U.S. has made any kind of change in law. This is the president tweeting something that at this point doesn't have any actual stick behind it or juice behind it besides him announcing that the administration is backing this.
Michael, I'd love for you to respond to Richard, who emailed, "You're missing the value of the Golan Heights. Until 1967, Syria kept firing down on Israel from the Golan Heights and had a commanding view of the Upper Galilee. Israel is now able to avoid Syrian aggression from Golan Heights." Michael, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, Richard is right in a historical sense. And we should point out to listeners who don't know the geography, I mean, it is a very short drive from the top of the Golan to Damascus. I mean, it's a matter of 40 or 50 miles. Courtney can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But the last time I did a big piece from Israel at the start of the Second Intifada, I was told by a pretty left-wing Israeli that the real reason they like the Golan is that it's been planted over with vineyards, and the really good Israeli wine comes from the Golan region. Hmm. And that's why Syria is never going to get it back. I mean, what I think is important to remember is that since there was the victory in 1973 when Israel was caught on the back foot in the Yom Kippur War. And then by the end of the decade, Egypt and then Jordan made separate peace with Israel. And I don't think that Syria on its own has ever been in a position to retake the Golan Heights, which is why it kind of, you know, Israel annexed it, but it was kind of de facto, as I said earlier. And I don't think that there's, Richard should remember that there's no likelihood of Syria coming at any time soon. I mean, Israel's interest at the moment in Syria is in monitoring, you know, Iran's involvement in the Syrian civil war. And we also often forget, because, you know, we're so America-centric, that, you know, the big player now in that civil war is not America. It's the Soviet Union. And Bibi Netanyahu is on the phone with Vladimir Putin a lot as well. He's not just in touch with Donald Trump and Jared Kushner. So it's quite complex, but I don't think that Syria has been any kind of threat to retake the Golan, to be in a position to, you know, rain shells down on Galilee as they did at one point. But that was 45, 50 years ago.
One more piece of this Israel story that I wanted to touch on before we move on and talk about what's been going on in New Zealand. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made some striking comments in an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network. A reporter from CBN News asked the secretary if it was possible that God raised up President Trump to help save the Jewish people from what the reporter referred to as the Iranian menace. Pompeo replied that as a Christian, he believed that could be possible. He said, quote, "I am confident that the Lord is at work here," unquote. And they also made a comparison to the story of Queen Esther in the Bible. Franco Ordonez, what do we make of this? I mean, Pompeo is entitled to his religious beliefs, but what about that?
I mean, Pompeo is entitled to his religious beliefs. He has very strong religious beliefs. I mean, one, I do think we should note the audience. This was the Christian Broadcasting Network. The audience was speaking to an audience who also has very strong religious beliefs. And this is not as eye-catching and ear-opening that this could be, you know, this is Pompeo's background. He often invokes his religion, his Christianity, in the work he does. He is among leading cabinet members who sit down every week with Mike Pence and others in Bible study. I think it's every Wednesday they get together, and they talk about how President Trump often speaks about God. this is also, I just want to note, this is something that the administration has embraced. Sarah Sanders, a couple months ago, she talked about, in a similar type question, she mentioned that God wanted Donald Trump to be president. And this is something that, you know, they are not afraid to invoke the Lord when talking about their duty here.
Although I got to say, Courtney, it is a leading question that the reporter asked. I mean, he asked, is it possible that God raised up Donald Trump? I mean, if you... No, it's impossible that God picked Donald. Like, what else was he going to say?
Yeah, I mean, the reporter pushed him in a direction that it would kind of be hard to veer away from.
Him.
But I will say Pompeo kind of grabbed it and kept running with it. Mm. So, you know, but we have to keep in mind, you know, as Franco was saying, this does not divert from where we know Mike Pompeo as a Christian, you know, as a strong man of strong Christian faith. I think the reason that it's so jarring to us is because we in this country have such a strong separation of church and state that to hear something like that, even the notion floated that President Trump was raised up by God to become the president of the United States to push aggression back on Iranian aggression is unusual for this country.
Let's shift gears to another story from around the world that's had our attention. It's been a week since a mass shooting left 50 people dead in New Zealand. Its Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, announced that New Zealand is making some big changes.
Today I'm announcing that New Zealand will ban all military-style semi-automatic weapons. We will also ban all assault rifles. We will ban all high-capacity magazines. We will ban all parts with the ability to convert semi-automatic or any other type of firearm into a military-style semi-automatic weapon. We will ban parts that cause a firearm to generate semi-automatic, automatic, or close to automatic gunfire. In short, every semi-automatic weapon used in the terrorist attack on Friday will be banned in this country. It's about all of us. It's in the national interest, and it's about safety.
That was New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Now, this national ban still needs to be approved by Parliament, but New Zealand's largest opposition party has already promised to support this measure. Michael Goldfarb, I wonder what your sense is of how this will play out, particularly because the opposition is on board, and there's also the practical matter of how the ban will work in terms of getting these weapons and weapon parts out of people's hands.
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, it's possible in a country like New Zealand, which is small, doesn't have 50 states with certain rights under a constitution to make their own gun laws, doesn't have an NRA. And, you know, it seems likely the reporting that I've seen from New Zealand, and we get quite a bit of it here because it's, you know, it's part of the British Commonwealth, indicates to me that, you know, people who live out in the bush and who have semi-automatic weapons, not so much to shoot other human beings, but because it's a pretty wild country down there. And if you're a farmer out in the middle of nowhere, you might occasionally need one of these things. They understand that there's a need to get rid of them. We had a similar thing here, by the way, in Britain 30-odd years ago. There was an attack on an elementary school in Scotland in a place called Dunblane. And within a fortnight, the gun laws were changed. Parliament had one of its rare moments of unanimity, and everybody came together. It's possible in a parliamentary system to say, you know what, we're taking these kinds of weapons off the streets. Pistols, you got to register them and keep them in a gun club. It's like that. You can't do that in the United States. And by the way, Andy Murray, the tennis champion, just by chance wasn't in Dunblane Elementary School that day when I think about 20 of his classmates were slaughtered. So it's an extraordinary story. But, you know, it's not something I think that's easily done in the United States.
It also, I think, kind of revealed some political fault lines, Franco, in New Zealand and Australia. There's a senator in Australia named Fraser Anning who's under fire after blaming the New Zealand attack on Muslim immigration. He's a far-right politician who's refused to back down, refused to apologize for the statement in which he said, quote, "The real cause of bloodshed on New Zealand streets today is the immigration program, which allowed Muslim fanatics to migrate to New Zealand in the first place," unquote. his comments may be a bit extreme, but how much does he represent a view among Australians? Is he saying something that some folks are thinking but just don't say out loud?
I mean, I don't think I can say specifically about how much his feelings represent those in Australia specifically, but there is no question that this these feelings are something that are spreading across the globe in the United States, in Europe. The Prime Minister talked about some of the anger against Muslims and other, the nationalism that is spreading across the global continent. What I find interesting, as Michael says, is how different it is there to the United States. There certainly seems to be an effort to take steps in that part of the world, while here in on our side of the globe, it is so difficult to make any move whatsoever. I think it was 6 days before they were passing laws to enact gun control. Here, we couldn't do it after Sandy Hook. We couldn't do it after Parkland. I mean, there's so many different examples, and we still seem to be at a stalemate.
It is worth noting, Courtney, that the backlash to this statement was basically instantaneous. A 17-year-old named William Connolly, upon hearing this, cracked an egg on Senator Anning's head at a protest rally. He was immediately smacked and then pinned to the ground by a group of Anning's far-right supporters, one of whom later referred to the Christchurch shooting as karma. So it feels like Connolly was brought in by the police. He was later released, but there's been quite a bit of cultural and political fallout from this. It kind of exposed some things that I think some folks would rather not have to talk about.
Yeah, Connolly, who's now being referred to as Egg Boy and has sort of become a bit of a cult hero. And I have to say, I watched the video of this happening and I was struck by how calm he stayed. He held a cell phone up and took video of himself doing it and stayed perfectly calm the whole time. I recommend that the listeners Google it and look at the video. I was struck. He was a 17-year-old kid who did this, but the Australian senator spun around and punched him and then kept going after him, which candidly, that surprised me. I mean, I think the thing that's really struck me about this and everything that's happened since this horrible massacre in New Zealand in Christchurch last week is that it stands in such stark contrast to how this is handled in the United States. You know, Michael and Franco both mentioned there's no NRA there. It's a smaller country. But what I was particularly struck by the Prime Minister was the confidence with which she made these comments. She said, "We will now ban these weapons." You know, New Zealand may be a small country, but it has a very low percentage of residents who register their guns, who register their weapons. The estimates are it's less than 5% are actually registered. So the idea that she feels that through buyback programs and whatnot, that she can actually take care of this problem, that she has that confidence, it just shows a level of leadership that I think has been very impressive from people around the world.
Let's talk Brexit. It has been delayed. I'm sorry, Michael, I know. Did I hear you groan just now?
If not, if he didn't, I did.
Yeah, I did.
Well, I'm sorry, but we have to because it's been delayed. We don't know for how, but for how long really has it been delayed? Remember, in 2016, the UK voted to leave the European Union, and last night, the EU agreed to extend next week's deadline. A week from today was supposed to be the day that Britain would split from the EU. This issue has paralyzed the country ever since. Millions of people still just don't know if this divorce ends in a deal or with Britain storming out of the house with the kids screaming. Michael Goldfarb, what is your sense of what this delay does for the Brexit process now?
Well, the general spin down from last night's meeting in Brussels, Theresa May, having had a very rugged week in Parliament, flew over to Brussels to lay out her plan one more time. Nothing new. Nothing new. And, it is really remarkable, Joshua, that, here's the Prime Minister of Great Britain. She's oversees business in what they still call the mother of all parliaments. It's the world's fifth or sixth largest economy, depending on how you measure. And it's total anarchy. There is no leadership. There's nothing. The political class is totally empty and bereft. She goes over there. They presents her usual whatever. I was going to say a bad word. I won't.
Thank you for self-censoring. Thank you.
Well, it's an Anglicism for testicles, and I think a lot of listeners will know what word I'm using. And, it's like, basically, after speaking for 90 minutes, she was invited to leave the room. And the heads of government of the 27 other members of the European Union hashed it out for her. She hasn't asked for an extension. They said, we'll give you an extension. You need at least this much time, we understand, till April 12th. If you haven't got your deal through then, you have, you know, then it's a crash out. If you do get your deal through then, through Parliament, you have 6 weeks to the end of May. And then Angela Merkel added, but you know, if you really want to just rescind Article 50, which is the notice you send to the EU to say, we are withdrawing, we as a nation are withdrawing from the European Union, you can have a year. It's okay. We don't mind. They took over, essentially. And so now here we are, and we have a new crash out date, which is April 12th. Thank you very much to the other 27 leaders. And meanwhile, as I speak to you, there is a petition at the government has a website where you can set up a petition in which, as I speak to you, more than 3 million people have now asked the government to rescind Article 50 and think it over again. They have no plan. The withdrawal agreement, which is all it is, it just says, these are the terms under which we withdraw. It isn't a new free trade deal with Britain's largest market,
right,
which is the other 27 countries on the other side of the channel, has not even been negotiated yet. So there's a possibility of reset. I said when this happened 2.5 years ago that it's an EU negotiation. It'll go past the deadline. It's going to go past the deadline at least 2 or 3 weeks. The problem is, and I say this to everybody listening in America, if you live here, and I now hold dual citizenship, it is a nightmare because you always assume, even if you have a crazy president, that at least the rest of the government is going to function. Nothing is functioning at a governmental level here. And it's a very strange sensation to live through this kind of, you know, anarchy in the air around you.
Yeah. And it is worth noting, Franco, speaking of presidents and his families, Donald Trump Jr. wrote an opinion piece for a big newspaper in the UK saying, essentially, you should have listened to my dad.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was very unclear what specifically the advice that Don Jr. was saying that President Trump gave to May. But certainly, you know, it's fascinating watching how the Trump team, his son, has kind of aligned Trump's kind of campaign and kind of drive into, you know, world politics and kind of aligned it with the Brexit movement and the fight against the establishment and efforts to silence the voices of those who need to be heard. You know, I think the administration, particularly Don Jr., is going to continue to be heard on this.
Much more to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Franco Ordonez of McClatchy, Courtney Cuby of NBC News, and Michael Goldfarb, the host of First Rough Draft of History. Prime Minister May repeated her belief that this deal is the best way forward. She also, after saying that, got a little pushback from her predecessor, Tony Blair. We'll tell you what she said and what he said, and we'll get some more of what you have to say. Stay close.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Franco Ordonez, Courtney Cuby, and Michael Goldfarb. Let's wrap up with Brexit and then keep moving. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Theresa May repeated her belief that her deal was the best way forward, and she berated members of Parliament who spent months attacking her plan. Mrs. May made this direct appeal to her country. Listen.
You, the public, have had enough. You're tired of the infighting. You're tired of the political games and the arcane procedural rows. Tired of MPs talking about nothing else but Brexit. You want this stage of the Brexit process to be over and done with. I agree. I am on your side.
Then, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair leapt to the defense of those lawmakers. Blair thinks Brexit would be a disaster for the UK. He said Parliament was doing its job and said Theresa May's deal is lousy and needs to be rejected.
Theresa May is saying to the British people, if you back my deal, all this Brexit thing would go away. We'd have closure of the argument. We'd all sail through to a nice future. It isn't right. It's not what would happen. Her deal resolves nothing. And what the MPs are doing is actually what they should do. They're looking at the detail and they're saying Northern Ireland's a mess and the future relationship's a mystery. And why on earth are we going to push the country down this path? It's not in the country's interest.
Courtney Cuby, I wonder what we expect to happen between now and this new deadline. I mean, you know, Parliament is kind of in uncharted territory. What's next?
So, I mean, one of the things I think a lot of people, including it sounds like former Prime Minister Blair, are looking for is for Theresa May, who, you know, in her defense, she inherited a really tough situation here, right? I mean, she came in on this. But they're looking for her to show some kind of leadership to actually come to some sort of a deal that people can agree to. You know, I think that's why the criticism of her in the past week or so has really reached higher levels, is that people are really looking to her for leadership. And she makes this speech. She addresses the country on Wednesday and says, no, I'm frustrated like you are. I want an end to this, but without really offering any kind of solution to the problems.
One more story out of Europe that caught our attention, and it has to do with the CEO of Volkswagen, Herbert Diess. He's under scrutiny for some language he used during a management meeting. According to a person who says they were present at that meeting, Diess said at some point, and I'll say it in German, Ebit macht frei, or profits will set you free. Those of you who know your Holocaust history probably immediately thought of the phrase Arbeit macht frei. Work will set you free. Those were the words that were inscribed over the gates at the entrance to Auschwitz. Michael Goldfarb, what?
Yeah, boy, you know.
I mean, is this kind of a piece with what Herbert Diess's reputation is? I'm not sure how to contextualize this in terms of Volkswagen or if this comes out of left field.
It comes out. It comes out of left field. It comes out of, I don't know. It comes out of a kind of. I think, you know, I'm not going to give the guy the. I'll give the guy the benefit of the doubt, okay, and say that he was making a kind of joke that no CEO of a major international automobile manufacturer or any major international concern should ever make. In public. Yes, Arbeit macht frei. I think probably everybody listening to this program has seen a photo of the gates to Auschwitz, knows what it means, and may have in other contexts said this, you know, made a joke out of, you know, dropping the Arbeit and just thinking macht frei. Okay? But it is also something that, don't they give these people media training anymore? But I also think that it has to do with the fact that the further away from the horror of the Holocaust we get, this kind of, I don't know, mundanifying of the horror, I've just coined a word there, making it ordinary so that people say, it's a joke. He was wrong, and he's been excoriated for it. And I think that's where I'd like to leave it.
Franco?
I'd just like to build on what Michael said. I mean, not only is this kind of the thing that you would not expect of any CEO, this is not the kind of thing you want from the CEO of Volkswagen, specifically considering the history that Volkswagen has. It was founded in 1937 under Hitler's rule. This is very, very sensitive. They have had to have special memorial events to provide support for people who were hurt, who were part of Volkswagen's early history. They used to use slave labor from concentration camps. This is extremely, extremely delicate. This is fire.
Let's move to Africa, where Cyclone Idai, a powerful tropical storm, has devastated parts of Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. Hundreds of people have been killed. An estimated 15,000 still need rescue. In Malawi alone, the UN says 80,000 people have been reported displaced. Jamie LeSueur, who's the emergency operations manager for the Red Cross, has called this the worst humanitarian crisis in Mozambique's history. We will continue to follow this story, and we'll bring this back to you on the roundup as the relief effort continues. Let's shift gears to Brazil, whose president was in Washington this week. Jair Bolsonaro praised President Trump and called the U.S. and Brazil, in his words, the two most promising democracies in the Western Hemisphere.
May I say that Brazil and the United States stand side by side in their efforts to ensure liberties and respect to traditional family lifestyles, respect to God, our Creator, against the gender ideology or the politically correct attitudes, and against fake news.
That was Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro speaking through an interpreter. Worth noting that President Trump then smiled and told reporters he was very proud to hear Bolsonaro use the term fake news. Franco Ordóñez, Bolsonaro has been referred to as the Trump of the tropics. Tell us why.
Yeah, he has been. And he hasn't shied away from that. Bolsonaro has made no secret of his affinity for Trump. He copied, if I could use that word, many of the phrases that President Trump used in his own 2016 campaign. Everybody remembers America first. Bolsonaro used Brazil first. Bolsonaro and his team, particularly his son, is seen as kind of a disciple of Stephen Bannon. They actually had Stephen Bannon, the former chief advisor, campaign advisor for President Trump, over to the embassy for a special dinner, and they see themselves as kind of an extension of the movement that Trump and Bannon kind of pushed in the fight against globalization. We were just talking about Brexit. These are very similar issues. And frankly, this is a dramatic turn of events in the hemisphere. Brazil and United States, the biggest economic powers in the United States. For over a decade, they had been at odd ends. There'd been very sensitive relationship. For those two countries now to be kind of aligned is really interesting.
And also part of Bolsonaro's appeal was some of his more conservative social views, at least among his political supporters. You heard him mention specifically respect traditional family lifestyles, respect to God, against the gender ideology and politically correct attitude. So that was a shift as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, he has not hesitated at all. Like Trump, he is considered a disruptor who has, you know, raised a lot of questions about human rights, of gay rights. He has, really shocked the entire hemisphere and gotten the attention of everybody. And it will be fascinating to see where this goes, because as you pointed out, Trump is a huge fan of Bolsonaro. He's very flattered of these comments of Trump's in the tropics, the use of fake news. And we could see a lot of talk about a potential free trade agreement in the future.
Courtney, President Trump also suggested that he might make Brazil a NATO ally during this visit. I don't think he has the power to do that, first of all, but why even say it?
Yeah, I mean, he said he might make them a major non-NATO ally, which would give the country some preferential treatment, specifically when it comes to foreign military sales and some technology purchases and transfers. But I think he, even after he said it, realized that what he was saying was not really possible, that he didn't have that authority. When I first heard it, I thought, well, the president has a fundamental misunderstanding of what NATO is, because it's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's a grouping of European countries that, based on its charter, 1949, which I went back and looked at after he said this, because I thought, well, maybe they can invite countries from South America around the world. Article 10 of the treaty, the Washington Treaty, actually says that it's for European countries. So every member would actually have to amend Article 10 and then agree to allow Brazil in, which, given the President Bolsonaro's, you know, anti-democratic comments and his attacks on democratic institutions, it doesn't seem plausible that that would happen. What I found particularly interesting about that entire press conference and all the coverage about that was it really reinforced the premium that President Trump puts on personal relationships, and how flattery really goes such a long way in opening doors with President Trump, and how President Bolsonaro really has learned how to do that and has mastered it with President Trump.
One more story we wanted to talk about, and usually the story that we leave as the kicker is just, you know, it's a few seconds at the end of the show, but we know that there are quite a few of you who want to talk about this, especially those of you who are parents. This might sound familiar.
Can I make a wish, Granny?
Of course, Peppa. Here's a little coin.
I wish, I wish, I wish.
Well, don't tell us what you're wishing for.
Okay. Finished!
Very good.
Granny, do the wishes always come true?
Yes.
Oh, goody!
That's Peppa Pig, very popular with the preschoolers. But this week, she drew the ire of a group of grown-ups, the London Fire Brigade. It tweeted an accusation against the children's show of using sexist language in an episode called The Fire Engine. Now, the show reportedly used the word fireman instead of firefighter. And that set off a firestorm on Twitter. Some parents came to Peppa's defense. They pointed out that the show's language may be outdated, but that Peppa's stories have included depictions of female firefighters, including Peppa's own mummy pig. Franco and Courtney, I understand you have children who watch Peppa Pig. I am very up on pop culture, but preschoolers are not my demographic, so you're going to have to help me with this. Franco, first of all, is this, like, why is Peppa Pig a thing?
You're asking me to get into the mind of my 4-year-old and 7-year-old.
And well, they're your kids!
And I'm not sure that I can do it on this one. But I will say that the accents are so cute and they're so adorable. And pigs like to jump around in mud. I mean, how is that not appealing and fun? And frankly, for my family, it's there's a lot of parallels. Peppa's the older girl, the younger boy, George. It's just kind of perfect for my children because I have the same demographics.
We should note, by the way, that this is a British animated series that airs here in the U.S. on Nick Jr. and on other networks around the world. Courtney, you have some different feelings about Peppa Pig?
I have twin 4-year-old boys who, because of Peppa Pig, you say tomato instead of tomato, because they cannot pass up a muddy puddle, as they call them, because Peppa love and her little brother love to jump in muddy puddles.
And her grandfather.
I can literally blame Peppa Pig for some of my children's behavior because they watch it so often. I fall asleep at night with the theme song in my head.
Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, I found this whole thing fascinating because, you know, this Twitter fight of, you know, well, girls can be firefighters. We don't call them firemen and everything. I mean, my children have picked up tons of bad behavior from Peppa. And I think the reason it really resonates with little kids is it's very simply drawn. They use very simple language.
Yeah.
And the themes are very simple. Everything about it is perfect for a 4-year-old, and it's perfect to drive a parent insane.
Well, Michael, we've only got a few seconds left, but is this a British controversy you want to stay out of in our last few seconds?
Well, listen, I just wanted to say that my kid was so precocious, she couldn't be bothered with Peppa Pig, and she has a natural British accent. She's just 13. Last night, I took her to see Follies at the National Theater, and she was really engaged with all the discussion of divorce. She's really very precocious.
She's way past Peppa Pig. Yes. Michael Goldfarb, host of the podcast, First Rough Draft of History. Michael, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Pleasure.
Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for McClatchy. Thanks, Franco.
Thanks for having me.
And NBC national security and military reporter Courtney Cuby. Courtney, thanks very much.
Thanks, Joshua.
1A senior team is Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, and Denise Couture. This episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Remember to send us your reviews of us. How many stars out of 5 and why? 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for watching and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.